Have you ever opened up an ancient text, maybe an Old Testament story you vaguely remember from when you were a kid, and suddenly you just feel like you're staring at this completely foreign landscape?
Oh, yeah. Like, you might recognize the characters' names, but the events are just, oh, they're bizarre.
Right. The pacing is super erratic, and you're just left sitting there wondering, what on earth is the actual point of all this?
Exactly.
Yeah.
It can be super intimidating.
It really can. So, welcome to today's deep dive. We have a very specific mission today, which is we're going to completely transform the way you read these ancient, sometimes really intimidating narratives.
We really are. And, to do that, we're pulling our insights entirely from Dr. Stephen D. Mathewson's work, specifically his session on preaching Old Testament
Yeah,
narratives.
and we're really zoning in on his process for analyzing the plot, right?
Right, which honestly requires this profound shift in perspective. Like, if you could see my study right now, my visual backdrop is essentially just wall-to-wall ancient scrolls and literary
Oh,
maps.
that's awesome.
Yeah, I chose that because the core premise we're exploring today is that these ancient stories, they aren't just, dry, dusty historical logs.
They're not just bullet points of ancient trivia.
Exactly. They aren't random at all. They are highly structured, masterfully crafted, plot-driven narratives, and they carry these massive, profound theological messages.
Okay, let's unpack this because I love that visual.
Yeah.
But before we even look at the architecture of the stories themselves, we really have to talk about the sheer effort it takes to extract that
Oh,
meaning.
for sure.
Because reading these texts, I mean, it isn't a casual Sunday stroll.
Not at all. And Dr. Mathewson uses this brilliant analogy to s set the stage here. He compares reading and studying these texts to climbing Long's Peak in Colorado.
Okay, Long's Peak.
Yeah, so for context, this peak is in the Rocky Mountain National Park, and it towers like 14,259 feet above sea level. Right? Reaching the summit requires this 8-mile hike just from the trailhead alone, and you're dealing with an elevation gain of almost 6,000 feet.
That is a serious trek.
Yeah.
My legs are burning and my lungs are screaming, just thinking about that.
Right, mine too. But the journey of understanding a text actually has two equally demanding parts that totally mirror that climb. So first, there is the grueling ascent.
The ascent there, yeah.
Yeah, the ascent is the hard exegetical work of figuring out the author's intended meaning.
Let me just pause you right there because you used a pretty heavy academic word, exegetical.
Ah, right, yeah.
So for those of us who, don't spend our weekends hanging out in theological libraries, that basically means the actual digging in, right? Extracting the raw facts and context from the text.
That captures it perfectly. Yeah. Think of it as pulling the original intent out of the soil of the ancient world, rather than just kind of projecting your own modern assumptions right onto it.
That makes a lot of sense.
So you have to climb up from the text to grasp its core theological thrust. But then you hit the second phase, which is the descent.
Getting back down the mountain.
Right. You have to get back down safely to deliver those goods, that meaning to an audience so they can actually apply it to their modern lives.
Right. Both the ascent and the descent have their own joys, but also their unique hazards.
Exactly. So to help us survive this grueling ascent up the mountain, Mathewson gives us a map.
A map or an acronym specifically, right?
He does. It's the ACTS acronym, ACTS, which stands for Action or Plot, Characters, Talking or Dialogue, and Setting.
And today, we're really intensely focusing on that very first step, right? The A.
Yes, the action. But, learning to analyze an ancient sacred story using this kind of structural framework, it can feel incredibly rigid at
I
first.
can totally see that.
Which brings us to another of Mathewson's analogies, which is baseball.
Okay, baseball. I'm with you.
Think of Everett Pujols, right? One of the greatest power hitters in the history of the sport. Before a game, facing a major league pitcher who's about to throw like a 95 mile per hour fastball,
Yeah.
how do you think Pujols warms up?
Well, I mean, you would assume he's in the batting cage taking the most aggressive, fast-paced practice swings imaginable,
That's
right?
what most people think. But he actually hits a ball off a stationary batting tee.
Wait, really? Like the exact kind of rubber tee that like 5-year-olds use in t-ball?
The exact kind. He deliberately slows everything down to a total crawl. He isolates the mechanics. First, he might just focus on his hands, making sure they roll correctly at the exact point of impact.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and then he stops, resets, and focuses entirely on his hips, just ensuring the rotational power is firing correctly.
So he's taking this super fluid, lightning fast motion and artificially chopping it up into these slow, deliberate pieces.
Exactly. He isolates the mechanical steps so that his muscle memory can take over when it actually matters. And we're doing the exact same thing with reading.
We're breaking down the swing mechanically.
Right.
I do have to push back on this just a little bit, though.
Sure, go for it.
I understand the sports analogy, but isn't it a bit, I don't know, clinical to break a sacred ancient text down like a baseball swing?
Yeah.
Like, if you hyperanalyze the mechanics of a story, don't you kill the magic of the narrative?
That is a very valid concern, and honestly, it's a trap a lot of scholars fall into. But, well, the goal of hitting off the tee isn't to stay on the tee forever.
Right. You have to play the game eventually.
Exactly. You break down the swing mechanically so that when you step up to the plate and that 95-mile-per-hour fastball comes at you.
Or in our case, the dense, complex, ancient narrative.
Yes. When you're faced with that soaring ancient text, your response becomes intuitive. You've internalized the structural mechanics so well that you can actually engage with the sweeping beauty of the story without getting totally overwhelmed by the speed and complexity of the ancient language.
Okay, that reframes it really nicely. The mechanics eventually fade into the background so you can just, you know, experience the story.
Exactly.
But to practice our swing, we first need to know exactly what we're swinging at. Like, you can't just pick a random verse in the middle of a book, close your eyes, and take a hack at it.
No, you really can't. You have to find the boundaries of the story first. And this is honestly where modern readers stumble the most.
Really? Why is that?
Well, especially if they're heavily accustomed to reading the New Testament letters. Like, in a letter like the Book of Colossians, you can easily isolate a single paragraph.
Oh, right. Like Colossians chapter 3, verses 1 through 11.
Exactly. You can pull that out and extract a perfectly complete thought. The logic just holds up on its own. But Old Testament narratives refuse to be treated that way.
They demand more context.
Yes, they demand that you select a complete unit of thought. And in a narrative, a unit of thought usually means an entire, completely resolved story.
So you can't just pull out three inspiring verses, slap them on a coffee mug, and call it a day.
You really can't. Attempting that will almost always lead you to misunderstand the text entirely. Like, take Genesis 38, for example.
Okay, Genesis 38.
If you try to isolate just the first 11 verses of that chapter, all you get is the exposition. You only have the setup.
The story hasn't resolved itself yet.
Right. To get the whole picture, you often have to read whole chapters. If you want to understand the narrative of David and Bathsheba, you cannot just read 2 Samuel chapter 11 and stop.
Because it leaves you hanging.
Completely. You have to read chapter 12 right alongside it. Because chapter 12 actually contains the resolution. The same goes for Judges 17 and 18. You just cannot sever them from each other without destroying the narrative arc.
So if I'm hearing you right, picking just a few verses of an Old Testament story is essentially like trying to review a feature film when you've only watched the opening credits.
That is a perfect way to conceptualize it, yes.
Like, you might know who the actors are, but you literally do not know the plot yet.
You're reviewing the setup, not the film itself.
But that raises a super practical issue. How do you know when the film is over?
Right.
Because if there aren't obvious modern chapter breaks in the original ancient texts, what are the actual clues? What tells the reader, okay, the story has officially ended?
Well, the primary boundary is the plot itself, you know, watching the central action actually resolve. But the ancient narrators also leave these brilliant, subtle literary clues to help you out.
Like what?
Huh?
What should we be looking for?
You might see a sudden change in time, like in Genesis 15, verse 1, which starts with the phrase, after these things.
Oh, so that signals a brand new narrative block has begun.
Exactly. But one of the most common and honestly almost deceptively simple clues is that the characters just simply go home.
Wait, really? They just pack up their stuff and go to their house?
I know. It sounds incredibly mundane to us, but in the literary architecture of these texts, a character returning home is like a neon sign flashing, the story is over.
Give me an example of that.
In Genesis 18.33, the Lord finishes speaking with Abraham, leaves, and Abraham returns home. End of the unit of thought. Or in 1 Samuel 15, after this massive conflict, Samuel the prophet just goes back to his home in Ramah. The tension is broken. The scene just fades to black.
Okay, so we've fenced in our story. We know the boundaries and we have our container.
Right.
But a boundary just gives us a container, right?
Yeah.
How do we actually figure out the payload the author hid inside that container? Like, what are we looking for?
We are looking for the central idea, and this requires a massive paradigm shift for the modern mind.
Because we think differently now.
We really do. Modern people, whether they're, you know, cowboys riding the range in Montana or chemists working in a lab in Chicago.
We absolutely love our bullet point lists.
We love them. We want articles titled Five Ways to Deal with Anger or Four Steps to a Healthy Marriage.
Right. We want the quick takeaways, the life hacks we can digest in 3 seconds flat.
Exactly. And to be fair, parts of ancient scripture do actually accommodate that. Like the Book of Proverbs utilizes lists heavily. Six things the Lord hates, for instance. Yeah. But narrative literature just does not operate that way. Preachers and readers will often try to comb through a story about, say, Isaac and Rebecca, and forcefully extract a bullet point list out of it.
Oh, like pulling out three leadership principles from a story?
Yes. Oh. Principles that the ancient author never intended. Narratives do not have lists. They have a single central unifying idea.
Okay, but how do we find a unifying idea if the author refuses to just, you know, list it out for us?
Dr. Mathewson points to a couple of modern secular examples that illustrate this perfectly. Years ago, a U.S. News and World Report article discussed the psychological purpose of the original Cinderella story.
The original one, okay.
Yeah, so the mothers who first told that fairy tale to their daughters, they were communicating a very specific underlying terror of that era, which was, the worst thing imaginable would be for me, your mother, to disappear, and for your father to replace me with another woman.
Wow. That is incredibly dark.
Right.
But it actually makes the architecture of that fairy tale make total sense.
Yeah.
It completely shifts the perspective.
It really does. Or think of the classic stop-motion Christmas special, Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer.
Oh, I love that one.
Right. So the underlying message of that story is that given the opportunity, you can turn a perceived liability into your greatest asset.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Now, obviously, a 9-year-old is not going to articulate it that way after watching the cartoon, but that is the subtle message they're absorbing. And ancient Old Testament narratives function the exact same way. They have a core central idea embedded deep within the events.
But I have to ask a probing question here.
Go for it.
If these ancient writers had a specific, urgent theological agenda, like, if they really wanted us to understand how God's people are supposed to live, why hide it in a subtle, sweeping story?
That's a great question.
Why make us work so hard to find the Rudolph moral? Why not just give the audience the bullet points and save everyone the trouble?
Because a bullet point only engages the intellect, right? And it usually just triggers our defenses.
Oh, that makes sense.
As Old Testament scholar John Salhammer points out, a text is an embodiment of an author's intention. A story bypasses our intellectual defenses entirely. It pulls us in, making us experience the tension, the failure, and the resolution right alongside the characters.
So it doesn't just hand you a sterile rule.
No, it shows you the devastating, heartbreaking consequences of breaking it, or the soaring beauty of keeping it. It engages the whole person, mind, emotions, and spirit. And to find that hidden central idea, we have to trace the A in ACTS. The action, or the shape of the plot itself.
So how do we actually trace that shape? What does the plot of an ancient story typically look like?
Plots in these narratives generally assume a shape consisting of four main stages.
Okay, four stages. Let's hear them.
First is the exposition. This is the background info that sets up the situation and introduces the characters. Second is the crisis, or sometimes a series of crises, conflicts, or rising tension.
Which you need, right? Because without a crisis, you literally do not have a story. You just have a diary entry.
Exactly. Third is the resolution, where the plot descends from the climax down to a solution. And finally, some stories have a conclusion, or what the French call a denouement, which simply ties up the loose ends after the main tension has evaporated.
Okay, so do we need to pull out a magnifying glass and pinpoint exactly which verse is the exposition and which verse officially starts the crisis?
No. And that's a trap that makes the reading feel clinical again. Moving between these four stages is, well, it's like driving a car with an automatic transmission.
Okay, it's fluid.
Very fluid. You don't have to push in a manual clutch and forcefully shift the gears. You shouldn't agonizing over whether the crisis officially begins in verse 5 or verse 11. You just need to recognize the general forward movement of the vehicle.
Let's see this in action, actually, because Dr. Mathewson uses Genesis chapter 38 as an example of this four-stage plot, and I really need some help here.
It's a great example.
Because I'm looking at Genesis 38, and honestly, if I read the first half, it just feels like a bizarre, scandalous soap opera.
It really does.
I am completely lost on where the theology or the central idea is actually supposed to be.
It is a fascinating, shocking test case.
Huh.
So let's trace the automatic transmission here. The exposition spans the first 11 verses, covering almost 20 years of history.
Okay.
We're introduced to Judah, who marries a Canaanite woman and has 3 sons. So that sets the stage. Then we hit a massive, rapidly escalating crisis. Judah's first two sons die, and he refuses to give his third son to Tamar, his daughter-in-law.
Which, in that specific cultural context, is essentially a death sentence for her, right? Because a male heir was required for a widow to have any economic survival or protection at all.
I say, she is left totally desperate, destitute, and abandoned by her father-in-law. So Tamar takes drastic action. She disguises herself as a temple prostitute and seduces Judah, who does not recognize him.
Here's where it gets really interesting. And see, this is what I mean. The sheer shock value of that narrative is just overwhelming.
Oh, absolutely.
How does a reader prevent themselves from getting totally distracted by the scandal and stay focused on the structure?
Well, the shock value is the crisis.
Exactly. And the tension drops instantly. The story resolves when Judah publicly declares, "She is more righteous than I," acknowledging that she was actually more faithful to the cultural expectations of family loyalty than he ever was.
Wow.
And finally, verses 27 to 30 act as the conclusion or denouement, listing the offspring born from this union. And crucially, those offspring eventually lead directly to the lineage of King David and ultimately Jesus.
It is wild that a story that chaotic on the surface is actually so tightly and masterfully constructed.
It is architectural brilliance. And the ancient writers didn't just use those four stages as a bare skeleton.
Yeah.
They dressed up the plot using highly specific literary tricks to force the reader to pay attention to the theology.
We have to learn to spot them, right? Let's go through some of those tricks. What's the first one we should look out for?
First, there are plot motifs, specifically comedies and tragedies. Now, a comedy in ancient literary terms does not mean a funny story with a punchline.
Right. It's not a sitcom.
Right. It means a U-shaped plot. The story starts in prosperity, descends into a dark crisis, but makes the turn back up to a happy restorative resolution. The Book of Ruth, the Book of Esther, even the story of David and Goliath, those are comedies.
Okay, and a tragedy.
A tragedy is a downward trajectory ending in ruin, like the life of King Saul or the story of Samson. Knowing the motif just helps you anticipate where the author is taking you.
That builds perfectly on the idea of tracing the plot. What else do they use to grab our attention?
Repetition. Dr. Matthewson shares this great story about his high school English teacher, Mrs. Blair. She would aggressively mark up his essays with a red pen, writing R&R, repetitive and redundant.
Oh, man. Yeah, in modern English, repeating yourself is considered poor writing. We're taught to use a thesaurus and find synonyms.
Right, you don't want to sound like a broken record. But consider the alternative in the ancient world. In ancient Hebrew narrative, repetition is actually a supreme virtue.
Yeah.
They didn't have italics. They didn't have bold text, highlighters, or larger fonts. When an author wanted to highlight something as fundamentally important, they simply repeated it.
Oh, that makes so much sense.
So when you see a word repeated, like the Hebrew word hizest, meaning loyal love, appearing over and over in the Book of Ruth, or a phrase repeated, like King David weeping, "My son, my son, my son," you need to stop and pay attention. That is the author putting the text in bold font.
Yeah, that completely changes how I'll read those repeating phrases.
Yeah.
It's not clumsy, redundant writing. It's the author screaming at us to look closer.
Exactly.
What about time? Because you mentioned earlier that the exposition of Genesis 38 covered 20 years in just 11 verses.
Yes. So that brings us to the trick of pacing.
Yeah.
This is the difference between narrated time, the actual time passing in the world of the story, and narration time, which is the physical space it takes the author to tell it on the page. In Genesis 38, 20 years fly by in a few short sentences. But then the climax, Tamar producing the seal and staff and Judah's confession, happens in real time, occupying significant space on the page for an event that took maybe an hour.
So the difference between narrated time and narration time is basically like a movie director suddenly using extreme slow motion during a chaotic fight scene. It's the author grabbing you by the collar and saying, "Don't blink, look right here."
That is exactly the dynamic. Wherever the author drastically slows down the pace to show you the minute details of a conversation or a specific action, that is where their theological emphasis lies. They are stretching time to make a point.
Wow. Okay, what's the last trick?
The final literary trick to watch for is irony. There is verbal irony, where a character says one thing but clearly means the opposite. Think of Macaulay's Kicking Samuel 6, sarcastically praising King David for honoring himself by disrobing to dance before the ark. She meant the exact opposite. She was mocking him.
But verbal irony is pretty common. What about dramatic irony? That's when the reader is essentially in on a secret that the character is totally oblivious to, right?
Yes, and ancient writers used it to devastating effect. Look at Judges chapter 4. We have a woman named Jael, and she's preparing to kill the sleeping enemy general, a man named Sisera. But she is not a soldier. She isn't using a sword or a spear.
What is she using?
She is using the household tool she has on hand, a tent peg and a worker's hammer. Dr. Matthewson points out how absurd and striking this image is. He compares it to assassinating a hardened military leader with a rolling pin and a vacuum cleaner.
That is a wild, almost darkly comical image.
It is. But the dramatic irony happens right before Sisera falls asleep. He is hiding in her tent, exhausted, and he tells Jael to stand at the door to guard him. He says to her, "If anyone comes and asks if someone is here, say no."
Oh, man.
His intention is to protect himself from his pursuing enemies. But you, the reader, know exactly what Jael is holding. You know what she is about to do.
Wow. So when he says, "Tell them no one is here," the reader knows that statement is about to be, ironically, fatally true. He is guaranteeing his own demise, and we are the only ones who know it. The author is just winking at us through the centuries.
Exactly. If we connect this to the bigger picture, it is a highly sophisticated literary device used to engage the reader's intellect and emotions simultaneously.
This has been incredibly eye-opening. So, to summarize our ascent up the mountain today, mastering the action or plot of Old Testament narratives means we first have to find the boundaries of the story to get a complete unit of thought. We have to stop demanding modern bullet points and start looking for the central idea hidden in the narrative. We trace the fluid movement of the four stages: exposition, crisis, resolution, conclusion. And we keep our eyes peeled for motifs, pacing, repetition, and irony.
You got it.
Next time you open up an ancient text, I challenge you not to view it as a dry, intimidating textbook, but to look at the gears turning in a masterfully crafted plot.
And as you reflect on how these ancient narrators built their stories, I want to leave you with one final provocative thought.
Let's hear it.
Dr. Matthewson notes a vital detail about this process. These biblical writers never manipulated or skewed the facts to make their theological points. They didn't have to invent things. They simply carefully selected which true events to tell and which details to emphasize to reveal their worldview.
Oh, that's really interesting.
So think about the stories you choose to tell about your own life. How does your careful selection of facts and the parts you choose to leave out craft a specific worldview or narrative that you are presenting to your friends and family?
That is such a good question. We are all shaping our own narratives every single day. Hopefully today's deep dive gives you some new tools to better understand the ancient stories you read and the personal stories you tell. Thanks for joining us on the mountain climb today. We will see you next time.